Oh, God, it's so good to see all of you. We've got hundreds of more people coming in. This is going to be an incredible event. Thank you so much, so much, so much. I'm Roseanne DiMauro, and I have the honor and privilege. Thank you. Thank you. That's so sweet. I have the honor and privilege of representing America's wonderful registered nurses, who are amazing. But everyone here is amazing. This is an incredible gathering. Honestly, it just shows the depth of the, when you find out and when you read your programs and when you get to know everybody here, the depth of the social and political movement, there are millions of us, and they've all come together, and we are going to fight to change this country, right? You know, that we've come together isn't a coincidence, but the most important task here is how we stay together, right? That's what's the most important, but we can do it. I'll tell you personally, I have to tell you thank you, because it is so wonderful to be in a room full of people of the non-co-opted and uncompromised. Thank you for that. I am so sick of my own generation, frankly, capitulating to everything that's out there. So I want to just talk a little bit. I know a lot of us are here because of we were together in the Bernie Sanders movement, but I want to talk a lot. We love you, Bernie. And we're not going away. But I want to talk about kind of the backdrop of all of this, because there is, it's not like all of a sudden Bernie Sanders came here and we all thought, oh, but there's a lot going on before, right? Yeah. Okay, so social and economic inequality, including racial and climate justice, affects each of us in our country. Of course, not the privileged, who have extreme control over our political system, creating and perpetuating a system of exploitation that's predicated upon private profit and greed. Neoliberal policies, which began in the 1970s, ripped away at the heart of our country and made everything for sale through deregulation, privatization, and austerity measures. They made our health, our education, and even our parks and sports arena commodities to be bought and sold. Thus, even our leisure became commodities. Here's the big thing, and everyone needs to know this, because when we're out there and we're talking in the world, neoliberalism doesn't mean liberal. It means bad. Bad. But I personally think, personally from my own perspective, liberals are usually bad too. Oh, I got my family here. They usually sell you out basically when you think they're with you, so just beware. But it's a goal. The goal of neoliberalism is to turn our nation into a giant market, to turn citizens and residents into apolitical consumers, and to replace civil and human rights with private property rights. In short, the architects of neoliberalism, including the corporations and the political class, armed the market against us. And unless it could make money, it was no longer valued. Good-paying jobs were destroyed. Many aspects of our living became unaffordable, and working people were forced to exist on debt. Our lives became for sale. The thing that strikes me the most about neoliberalism is that corporations and the 1% redefine the concept of free. This is the thing that bothers me the most, I think. Free. To mean this, free means security, right? But the hostility against the promise of Medicare for all, free public education, tuition, symbolizes how far we've sunk as a country. These are all now seen as commodities where they should have been basic human rights. In short, human rights have been perverted into a vilified entitlement. Once Wall Street took control of our country, most of our politicians and institutions, they collectively turned their back on human suffering. But throughout history, Oppression has always created resistance and struggle. And now we're at a crucial, critical mass, and we're at a turning point in history. Many people are here because of the Sanders movement. But most of the Sanders movement did not exist in isolation. Many economic and social forces of resistance predated this electoral cycle, right? They included what? Occupy Wall Street. Shout out. Immigrant rights movements. Labor protests against low wages and anti-union laws. Black Lives Matter. Students against sweatshops and students against debt. The climate justice movement. Opposition to the TPP. Campaign for a tax on Wall Street. You have heart. You have heart. The fight for single-payer health care. And, of course, the movements for gender equality and marriage equality. In the long struggle for justice, we need victories and achievements, and the achievements of the Sanders campaign have been victories of mass proportions. But it's important to remember that elections are not movements, but they can be a moment in a movement. And this is a magical moment in history. Just be proud. It's a break with the past. It's a political rupture. Let's look at it. And I know some of the Sanders folks are in the room, and thank you so much for the work that you've done to help us get to this point. This movement galvanized millions in the political arena. It outed our economic system, showing that unrestrained capitalism and corporate greed are not in the public interest. It convinced millions that the proper role of government is to care for our people. What a radical concept, huh? It challenged a bipartisan consensus on austerity economics and budgeting so corporations could make more money at enormous cost to our people of this nation and our planet. It made us think big. It made us think big and not to lower our expectations. It attempted to build a national campaign of uncompromised solidarity with all working people and unions, not a faux partnership between labor and capital. Perhaps most importantly, it demonstrated that it's possible to have a national campaign that's not funded by corporations and billionaires, but of, by, and for the people. While Bernie's campaign attempted to bring us all together, there was resistance on the part of some who are still enmeshed within the political establishment. And that is in part, this is hard to hear, I know, why our movement for presidency fell short. And yes, believe me, I know, there was massive corruption in the political machinery of the Democratic Party. And I know the press is in the room, but there was not so subtle manipulation by the press. The only way that we can overcome that corruption and manipulation is for all of us not to work in isolation, to understand that all of our struggles must be united before any one of them can be fully accomplished. What I love about this moment in the movement is the injection of the new energy, good analysis, and most importantly, unity of purpose. In this unity of purpose, where we come together, we will build and we will win. I'm almost finished here, but I just want to say that regardless of who is in the White House, no matter who is in the White House, we need to learn the lessons from the Obama years where the movement was built on hope and change. The moment that Obama got in office, the movement went away, and Wall Street occupied the White House, and like termites, they ate away at the foundation of democracy. The most important thing here is that there will always be termites, but we can never, ever go away, regardless of who's in the presidency. It sounds simple? It isn't. But other countries have shown us that it's completely within our reach. The Sanders campaign was not radical. It opened the door to our taking back our country to the financial sector, from Wall Street, if you will. In order to succeed, we must show up, and I don't mean just online. We need to show up for each other's collective struggles in the streets and in our communities. We're here to build a lasting unity, and to lead us in the first discussion of this is Juan Gonzalez. Juan Gonzalez is the co-host of Democracy Now! And an award-winning former columnist of the Daily News. And he was the first reporter in New York City to consistently expose the health impact of the September 11th attacks and the cover-up by the government officials. Juan is a longtime champion of human rights and democracy, and we're so pleased to have him here with us at the People's Summit. So please, People's Summit, welcome Juan Gonzalez.
Thank you, and good evening to all of you. To all those Democracy Now! Listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. It's been quite a year, hasn't it? Most of us have not seen a year like this in our lifetime as adults. So we have a lot to discuss this evening. We have a real all-star lineup of incredible intellectuals and activists to engage in a conversation about where this amazing movement goes from here. Obviously, as Roseanne has said, there has been an enormously huge popular movement that has swept the country, and I want to introduce the people that are going to engage in this conversation. First is someone who needs very little introduction to those of us who've been involved in chronicling the movement for social change in America for the past few decades. She's Naomi Klein, an award-winning journalist, syndicated columnist, and author of the New York Times and number one international bestseller, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. She's also a contributing editor to Harper's and a reporter for the Rolling Stone and regularly writes a column for The Nation. She won the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Journalism for her reporting for Harper's on Iraq. Her latest book, of course, many of you here have read it, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate, the 2014 winner of the prestigious Hillary Weston Writers' Trust Prize for nonfiction, and another instant bestseller on the New York Times list, Naomi Klein. We also have with us John Nichols, national correspondent for The Nation magazine, which endorsed Bernie Sanders for president. John's new book, People Get Ready, with his traveling buddy and co-conspirator, Robert McChesney, about how we can take back our democracy, is extremely timely right now and will receive, according to one reliable source, the lead review in this Sunday's New York Times. His other book, The S Word, A History of Socialism in America, John Nichols. Hey. Also with us is someone who has been extremely active in the Bernie Sanders campaign and active in Hollywood, trying to get some of these stars to take clearer stands on the issues of the day. Rosario Dawson, the star of more than 50 films, including Men in Black 2, Rent, Sin City, Unstoppable, and Cesar Chavez. Rosario Dawson. Now, we're going to try to get into where does this movement go from here. And hopefully, we'll be able to do it in a way recognizing our unities and our differences. But I want to share with you a brief experience of my own and the problems that I had in being able to deal with a presidential race. It was 1968, right here in this city of Chicago. It was the Democratic National Convention of 1968. Mm-hmm. I was a young student right out of Columbia, the Columbia student strike of 1968, and we came to Chicago to confront the Democratic power brokers over the issue of the war in Vietnam and racism in America. We had toppled the president. The movement had toppled the president when Lyndon Johnson announced that he wasn't going to run for re-election. And Eugene McCarthy had swept the country with his legion of McCarthy young people. Robert Kennedy had been killed in June of 1968, and it looked like the country was about to implode. We're talking about 1968 when there was a riot, not in one city, Ferguson or Baltimore. In April of 1968, there were 100 riots in 1 week in the United States after the assassination of Martin Luther King. And so it looked like the country was on the verge of civil war, and all of us from SDS and the anarchist group, which was at that time the Yippies, and a group called Up Against the Wall, Motherfucker, and the McCarthy kids, we all met in Lincoln Park to confront the power brokers. And of course, there was tear gassing, beatings. Richard Daley even had his police ordered to shoot people on sight who he thought were looting. Our chant then was, the whole world is watching. And the whole world was watching. But the world got a different message than the one that we were putting forth. The result was, as many of you probably recall, Richard Nixon was elected president against Hubert Humphrey in a very narrow race, only because George Wallace was also running for president and got about 13% of the vote and siphoned off all of these supporters of the Democratic Party, white working class folks, which began the huge Republican Southern strategy that prevailed for years to come. We in SDS refused to vote. We wouldn't support McCarthy. We wouldn't support Humphrey. Our slogan was, vote with your feet. Vote in the street. I'm here to tell you that the slogan was right, the tactic was wrong. I think that the country, in retrospect, there would not have been a substantive change. There would have been a positive change if Nixon had not been elected. But you learn from your mistakes. Hopefully, other generations learn from the mistakes of those who came before them. So we're going to open up this discussion now to discuss, where does this movement go from here, this incredible movement? Do we seek to reform the system, transform the system, overthrow and replace the system? What are we trying to do? And I'd like Naomi to start off, especially talking about the conversation has been won among the public against neoliberalism, but neoliberalism proceeds ahead anyway. And what do you see as the vision for where this movement should go?
Thank you. Thank you, Juan, and thank you for sharing that hard-won wisdom. Thank you all for being here. I could go on and on about how much I love every person I'm on stage with right now. I'm so honored to be here. I want to talk about nurses for a minute, though, just before we start. I want to thank Roseanne so deeply for opening up this space for us. We need it so badly. You knew that we would need to gather, that we would need a place to look each other in the eye, to talk, to strategize, to plan next steps. And I just want to thank you and Nurses United for your courage, the joy you bring to this movement, the fact that you have stood with all of our movements without hesitation, without those, you know, political calculations, and just done what's right again and again and again. It has not gone unnoticed. We're not making speeches here, but I am a writer, and I did jot a couple notes down on the way here, just thinking about this gathering and my gratitude for the people who made this possible. There are so many groups who labored to make this extraordinary gathering possible, and of course, the Sanders campaign is what brought us together in so many ways. It's not the only thing that brought us together. But it was the nurses who got the ball rolling on this particular gathering, who opened your arms and said, let us gather, let us plan. And I want to say that it's fitting that it's nurses, because we come here energized by all that we have accomplished, all the ways in which we've surprised ourselves, gone further than we imagined, the really tangible victories of our movements in recent months and years. But let's not be afraid to admit that we also come here wounded, and that we also come here in pain, and that for a lot of us, and I don't think I'm just projecting, that pain feels very close to the surface. We are grieving political losses, dreams tantalizingly tasted, but ultimately unrealized, and we are also grieving the real loss of lives, grieving the extinguishment of those 49 bright, beautiful lights in Orlando less than a week ago, grieving the loss just yesterday of a young British politician named Joe Cox, a defender of Syrian refugees, of women's rights, an anti-poverty crusader, gunned down and stabbed in her constituency office in an act of hate, and I could go on and on listing these attacks. Thank goodness for nurses who have created for us a space in which we can begin to heal, from which we will emerge stronger and ready for battle once again. Let's show our love for nurses, for all. Guided by so much heart and so much principle. And let's hear it for all the caregivers, the nurses, the daycare workers, the elder care workers, the teachers, the glue that binds together our communities. And, you know, I don't think that this is by happenstance that we are brought together by caregivers, because I think at the very heart of this revolution that we're talking about is a revolution in shifting our economy, our political and economic system away from one based on endless taking, endless extraction from the earth as if there are no limits, as if we can take and take and take without consequence, that endless taking from workers' bodies, from our communities, as if there is no breaking point and no consequence, to a society that is grounded in that first principle of caretaking, of caring for the earth and for one another. That is where we start. and of cherishing. This shift is a fundamental rejection of the sacrifice zone mentality, the sacrificing of particular places to oil drilling and fracking, and the sacrificing of bodies that are supposedly worth less because they are black and brown. This is a fundamental shift in values that we are talking about here, and it is revolutionary, but it grows from the heart. So thank you, Roseanne, and thank you, Nurses United, for bringing us here. So neoliberalism lost the argument.
It's bad.
They lost the argument to the extent that, you know, not only was Bernie out there calling himself a socialist, not apologizing for it, making these arguments that, you know, we not reductions in tuition, but free college, you know, just pushing the envelope, 100% renewables, just going all the way, and people were cheering. And he forced Hillary Clinton to move to the left. And we also saw that even Donald Trump had to throw out the neoliberal rule book, trash-free trade agreements, promise to defend the social safety net in order to build his base. It wasn't just racism that got him where he is, although that's been a big part of it. So you know, this ideology that has you know, imprisoned our imagination for so long, that told us we could never get to this place, that our ideas had to be smuggled in under pseudonyms and, you know, under cover of night, right? That all of that is not true. These ideas are deeply popular. But that doesn't mean that neoliberalism is dead, because neoliberalism was never first and foremost an ideology. The ideology was always the cover for the greed, right? And so now, we still see these brutal neoliberal policies being pushed, not with any semblance of this is going to be good, this helps, but under cover of crisis, right? I mean, we see it in Puerto Rico, we are seeing it in Brazil in the aftermath of a coup, and I think it should be called a coup. We see it in Chicago. We see it in the Chicago school system. So the war against neoliberalism is not over, and this is what we need to strategize about. But I don't think we win this war defensively just by saying no. I think we have to say no, but we also have to articulate this incredibly inspiring, intersectional, holistic yes that we agree on, a new story, a new narrative. Just one last thing, just about what you said about 68. I had the great privilege of living in Argentina for a couple of years, making a film called The Take, La Toma, about workers who unfired themselves. Their factories were being closed down in the midst of economic crisis, and they occupied their factory, something that workers here in Chicago know a little something about, Chicago Windows and Doors.
Yeah.
And they fired the boss. They said, you know what, you might not want to keep this factory running, but we're going to turn it into a democratic worker cooperative. So we were there during an election campaign, and the slogan of the social movements was, our dreams don't fit on your ballots. And, you know, I think that, and that didn't mean don't vote. It meant some people voted and some people didn't vote. But no one was under any illusion that what that was being written on that ballot represented the world that they wanted. That was work that we were doing elsewhere, and that's the work we're doing here.
And John, how does a movement, especially now at this critical time of a presidential race and in the aftermath of a presidential race, how does a movement like this consolidate, learn the lessons necessary, and go to another stage? Because movements rise and movements fall. And unless you are able to consolidate the key lessons at each period, and as capitalism has been so resilient at shape-shifting, how does the movement adapt to the new conditions?
I got good news for you. This movement is going to rise. Next question. No. I got to do the same thing Naomi did, which is to say that as I travel around this country to every state and to every place where there is a struggle, and to every place where there is suffering and there is need. I always get there a little late because National Nurses United members and activists are there first. In the state of Wisconsin, when we rallied against Scott Walker and the austerity agenda that he brought to our state and that he sent out across this nation, when I looked out over those crowds, first of 10,000, then 50,000, then 100,000, then 150,000 people taking over their Capitol and standing up to austerity, when I looked out over those crowds, I saw from day one National Nurses United rushing to the barricades and ready to fight against austerity. They didn't ask about the issues. They just knew the fight was there and they were going to be in the front lines. Brothers and sisters, I wouldn't want to be with anybody else. And I wouldn't want to be with anybody else on a day when, as Naomi mentioned, and maybe we will all do this, but we should, that we are in mourning. 49 of our lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered brothers and sisters and their allies are dead. And they are dead because of a hatred that we must understand is as much a part of the political threat as neoliberalism. And we ought not separate it. We must recognize that when you create insecurity, when you divide people, when you seek to conquer by separating gay from straight, black from white, immigrant from native-born, when you keep trying to separate people, eventually you create a chasm of hate. Brothers and sisters, we are here today to step over that chasm and say that in the name of those who died at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida, we will never again allow anyone to discriminate against our LGBTQ brothers and sisters. And that's a big deal about this movement. That's a big deal about this movement. We can't just be about economics. We have to be about everything. We have to pull it all together. And let us also understand that Joe Cox, a comrade for many, many years, who before she became a member of Parliament a year ago, all they ever do is talk about politics, and this is to the point. All they ever do is talk about politics in our media. All they ever do is talk about who's an elected official. Elected official Joe Cox has been in her position or was in her position for 1 year. Activist Joe Cox, active with Oxfam, Save the Children, women's rights, anti-poverty, and anti-war movements, was in the struggle for 20 years before she went to Parliament. And she took to Parliament a movement ideology. She stood up against discrimination against Muslims. She stood up against discrimination against immigrants and refugees. She was a member of Britain's Labour Friends of Palestine, and she stood up for the people of Gaza. And if the reports are right, she died because of her advocacy for a whole and humane and decent Britain and a whole and humane and decent world. We mourn her, but we say we will remember the name of Joe Cox as we struggle forward and say never again will we forget a solidarity movement in this country or around the world. Now, Juan asks about struggle and moments and how we pull together. We already pulled together. We did a terrific job of pulling together. And we did it before a presidential race. If we had a media in this country that actually covered politics, we would know that since the Wall Street meltdown of 2008, when Americans saw exactly what the priorities of our economic and political elites were, and began to form movements against austerity, against economic injustice, against the racial divisions that extend from that injustice, in favor of immigrant rights. You know, we have had these movements. Climate change has been in the streets. The fact of the matter is these movements existed before this presidential campaign, and they were on the rise. And one of the biggest mistakes we make is to let a presidential campaign tell us we are not rising, tell us that we are not getting someplace. Brothers and sisters, 5 years ago, I wrote a book about socialism in America. And the fact of the matter is, people said to me at that time, are you sure you want to write about socialism? Are you sure you want your name associated with the S word? Well, brothers and sisters, this year, millions of Americans have associated their name with the S word in states across this country, and they have embraced a social democratic, democratic socialist vision of our future. It happened. So please don't tell me, maybe my expectations are a little low, but please don't tell me that nothing happened this year. I think everything I was looking for started to happen. And I will just close off with one little thought here about this great city of Chicago. When I was a kid, I specialized in losing campaigns. My first experience was knocking doors for George McGovern. And in this audience, I know it's dangerous, but I might say still the most decent man ever to run for president of the United States. Oh, and then when I was a little bit older, I was out there with Jesse Jackson. Oh, my gosh. But, you know, I came down, the first thing I ever got really involved in was here in Chicago. And it was 1983 for Harold Washington. But, you know, the interesting thing about Harold Washington? Before he ran for mayor and won, he ran for mayor and lost. And one of the most important things to understand about politics is the elites want us to focus only on wins and losses. Because if they can get us into their game, if they can get us into their narrow circle, then that's all that matters, right? Oh, they put more money in. Oh, they had some rules on their side. Oh, they won. And so we're supposed to stand down. Brothers and sisters, Eugene Victor Debs, the great labor organizer and socialist, ran for president of the United States in 1900 and 1904 and 1908 and 1912 and 1920. And the history books tell us that he never won. But brothers and sisters, in each of those campaigns, he preached about putting people who were out of work in jobs. He preached about electrifying rural America, getting the power out to the people. He taught about using the government to make better the lives of the individuals. He died in the mid-1920s, but in 1932, Franklin Roosevelt was elected President of the United States of America. And one of the first acts that Franklin Roosevelt did was invite Norman Thomas, the socialist candidate for president, not five times, but six times, to the White House. And if you look at what Eugene Victor Debs preached in each of those losing campaigns, if you look at what Norman Thomas preached in his losing campaigns, you will find the underpinnings of labor law protections, of protections for farmers, of protections for women, of an end to child labor, of Social Security, of all the programs that we now associate with those who won. Brothers and sisters, we never lose. We always win because we always rise.
I'd like to ask Rosario, who's very upfront in her support for Bernie Sanders, mm-hmm. took a lot of heat from a lot of places. In terms of the where you see this incredible movement going, what's the vision that is most important for folks to cling to at this time as we head into these conventions of both the Democrats and the Republicans, and then the election in November, and most importantly, what happens afterwards?
I will start with the nurses as well.
As you must.
As it pertains to my answer, and I think it is fitting to have stumped alongside so many of you across this nation during this campaign, because nurses know the long game. They understand how long care takes. They understand how much time and patience is required for change. And that is the moment that we're in right now. That there is a history that has led up to this moment that allows us to step on the backs of so many people who gave us the leverage to be able to speak as powerfully as we are, to be able to organize as well as we have, to be able to continue to reach out to each other despite the narrative that we are being fed. And I think ultimately that is the rising that you are talking about, because it has long since been happening and it will continue to happen because the reasons for it belie election cycle calendars. They are connected to our day-to-day lives. That is what is at stake, is our communities, our friends, our families, our future. And that's not going to go away regardless of who became president. Even if Bernie Sanders had long since clinched the nomination, we'd all be going, okay, what's next? And knowing that we'd had a lot of work to do. I can just say I have been so moved since I was a child, really, about how people help each other. I grew up in New York City during the crack and heroin and HIV/AIDS epidemics. I grew up during a time of massive gentrification, which is shocking compared to the gentrification we're experiencing right now. I watched the narratives being told about squatters like myself who were bleeding the city of money, and then watching how the city then spent millions upon millions of dollars to watch and occupy empty buildings and use police riots over days at a time to clear out parks and homeless people, and, you know, just watched these disparities over the years. Watched how people colluded together and worked together when certain needs were needed to be met, like sewage lines and water and heat and electricity, and how the second everybody got those things, personalities came out and the fighting began. Because when we start to lose the common thread that holds us together, our priorities shift, and how that ends up undermining our collective goals because we can't figure out how to communicate with each other to get there. I've just seen so many things and that have been so illuminating, especially now, going and putting myself out there. I've been, you know, talking about not going straight but gaily forward, and doing everything that we can for our LGBTQI communities, doing everything we can for our youth, for our homeless, for housing, for just so many different issues that I grew up with, poor people helping poor people, organizers, community organizers. And now we're at this moment. I've watched all of those things be talked about for years, where, you know, just going back, like people pushing back against, you know, needle programs. You know, people all having, even on the same side, having really different approaches about how to move forward. And because right now we are in a not leaderless but leader full moment, it's going to be messy, I think, continuing to go forward, because there is a lot at stake. And there's a lot of learning to do about each other's causes and personal reasons as to why we're moving forward. And we really need to listen. and learn and ask questions and be curious and be open, because there's a lot at stake, and having the opportunity to speak on behalf of a community or a demographic or an issue is a lot of responsibility. And we have to be willing to do the work, to hear each other in order to speak for each other and stand with each other. It's not just one part. And I can just say I've been beyond encouraged traversing this planet, let alone this country in this election cycle, with just that energy. As you say, the movements come and there's these different swells, the currents are different, and different moments breed different opportunities. And we are in a remarkable opportunity as we are reflecting on the past century and embracing and stepping forward into this new century with the technology and the opportunities and the network for good that exists, that is so connected in order to do so, but recognizing that we have to collude. We have to do this, what you have done for us right now. I'm so thrilled to be here. I'm so grateful that this exists, that this forethought in the movement was focused on and committed to in order to bring this moment for all of us to be together, not knowing what would be happening around us in the election, but just knowing that we would need to be together no matter what. And we do. We very much do need to have visibility with each other. It's great that we have these hashtags that go off and that we are talking to each other in our different groups, but we need visibility. We need to see each other. We need to preach to the choir and invigorate each other. And that's the thing that I feel like I've walked away with the most in this whole campaign, is this calling to encourage courage. And you all are doing that. And we need to continue doing that. To do, as you said, like putting feet to the street and go, come out. I know
vote,
I'm an actress.
Vote with your feet and vote in the streets.
I say you got to march, and you got to march to the polls. You got to have both. This has to be a comprehensive thing. And sometimes that does mean some people are going to vote, and some people are going to organize, and some people are going to translate, and some people are going to get arrested, and some people are going to do this. But we really need to support each other in all of those different instances, understanding that corporations and businesses and trades and countries, all of those things, they all work with each other, and they have a long game. They're like, I'll scratch your back, and in 4-8 years, you scratch my back. And they've got this long game going, and we're stuck in this cycle of reaction and fighting for the little bits of stuff that we can get, and that's not working for us. I've seen that over and over and over again in the philanthropic community, where people are going, I have a certain amount of money I need to make this year, and I'm going to lobby for it. And if that other organization that's helping children doesn't get it because that's the only funds that they had, oh, well, I kept my organization alive. No. You both need to persist. How can we make it so that those monies come to all of us and we all work together and work collaboratively with each other so no one is sacrificed? Because they're not sacrificing each other up there. They're all working with each other. And even when it looks like, oh, there's something, maybe they've fallen out, like, don't get it twisted. Deborah Wasserman Schultz is going to be hooked up somewhere, somehow. Like, don't get excited by the news of being like, oh, she's going to leave as the DNC chair, and something like that means like she's getting a slap on the wrist. No, that's long since been figured out. These are gestures and movements and things of, yeah. Like, it's not, we have to be able to see through these moments of being reactive and be proactive. And being proactive means staying the course. And that was required before this movement of movements, and will long since come after, because, you know, it's never like you just win once. You win, and then you've got to defend your position. And you lose, and you've got to defend your position. You win, and you lose, and you win, and you lose, because there's a lot of us here, and we're all grappling towards things, and we need to have more understanding. Otherwise, we're stuck in the same cycle where, like, every couple of years, we get a new president, and half the country feels like they lost, and they just dig their heels in against everything, and then run on the platform of undermining everything that just, any progress that was made. That's not a way to have any kind of progress. That's not building anything. That's not creating anything. And I've talked to so many people who are absolutely interested in exactly that, creating things and developing things, particularly relationships, networking with each other, talking to each other, recognizing, wow, I did a lot of organizing. I did a lot of phone banking. I did a lot of door knocking and canvassing. You know what? I could do that for you. Do you want to run for office? Or how about me? I'll run for office. But these are the conversations that I'm seeing of young people and people across the nation who are discovering their power because they were compelled to do something that moved them, that was felt like a calling that they did without even really thinking about it. Like Shailene Woodley had this pin that says, you know, I was going to get into Bernie Sanders and I just thought, you know, it'd be a part of my life, and then I just decided, why not let it consume my soul? And that's what this movement has done for people. They're like, this is what I need to do. This is my life. I wasn't alive until this moment. And now I'm so alive, and there's no going back on that. So this narrative of like, oh, you lost and you're a sore loser is like, wait, I'm sorry. I'm looking at a sea of thousands of people. I don't know how this is losing. If this is losing, then give me some more of that.
Well, 'cause I'd like to follow up on that. Roseanne, one of the things that Bernie Sanders talked about this week in his message to supporters around the country was this whole issue that obviously a revolution is not made at the top. It is made through millions of people getting involved. His call for people to run for office at all levels of government, you know, whether it's your local school board, whether it's your city council, your state legislature, that, you know, in the 60s, we used to have a saying, create one, two, three, many Vietnams. You know, it's a question of, you cannot stop a movement by stopping one particular leader if that movement promotes many leaders. Your sense of how that call is being heard.
Well, I've considered the fact that I like my retirement job to be a political scout, so I could take care of all the liberals. I would get only the progressives, and then I would actually talk to Bernie, and we'd send one of his emails out, and then they'd run for office. That's my fantasy. But Bernie's serious. I was at Bernie's house on Sunday with a core group, and one of the things that, and I got to listen in a different way because it was in his living room. He was very relaxed. He really is, like, Bernie's the real deal. I mean, I just have to say that. He just is. And he's so committed to doing that at the school board level, you know, at the community level, at the state level. And I think what we have to do is to find the right people. And that's one aspect. And he understands that the movement is not the elections. But I'll tell you, I was in his living room with some of the electeds in this country, and there were some good people. Yeah. And I just thought, you know, the press was all outside, and here was the, you know, some congressmen, senators, and they were standing with Bernie. Now, some of them have endorsed Clinton. There was enormous pressure to do that because they basically, it became a very negative dialogue. If you're not with Clinton, then you're pro-Trump. And that was really, the Democratic Party did that to their people, and it was sad. But they stand with Bernie. They stand with the ideals. They were in that living room, and I was thinking, it was kind of refreshing to actually hear them because they come from the heart, and they want to make change, and they're willing to stand up like Keith Ellison, for example, Congressman Keith Ellison, and do what Bernie's... Minnesota out there, and do what Bernie Sanders has done. Bernie has been the lone voice in the legislature for so long with none of us behind him, and now he has a movement with millions and millions and millions of people. And we need to do that with the electeds. We need to help them. We need to support them.
We need to get our mic adjusted.
Thank you. We need to fund them. And so Bernie's plan, I believe, I know I get in trouble for this, but I believe it's basically not to turn over his email list, yay. to basically connect everybody up on the electoral realm and say, you know, can you help this person out? There was one young congressman there from South Carolina, I believe, and he was so grateful because Bernie sent out an email for him, and then Carvina, or what's the man's name in Florida? Cordova. Yeah. Yeah. And basically, so to take out Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Yeah. And, but just on that, Debbie Wasserman Schultz isn't the problem. It's Wall Street behind Debbie Wasserman Schultz, just to be clear.
Yeah.
Not that I think she's an innocent, I just look behind the curtain. But he's serious about that, and that with that list, we can continue to build. Winnie Wong from People for Bernie, right there, Winnie Wong. Wonderful, Winnie Wong, People for Bernie, was telling me last night that we've reached, how many people did you say, Winnie, in terms of the emails, the email list and the social media list? 130 million. Yes.
I couldn't be at that meeting on Sunday. I told Shailene, I was like, the one text I sent her was like, just tell him he cannot give up that email list.
No.
I refuse.
No, she was good. She was out there for you. But 130 million people. I mean, that is amazing. This is our country. Bernie's going to help us take it back, but we got to do that ourselves, too.
Yes,
so I agree with you, Juan. They need to run. It's you. Heroes aren't made. They're cornered. That's you. Right? That's you.
But there are a lot of people who want to run for office, and that was the thing, that I saw people, in the same way that this election is so remarkable because people are registering themselves, they're registering others, they're organizing themselves, they were phone banking, they were canvassing, and there's just this energy of just going, wow, I got really into that, I got really addicted to that, that was really powerful, and I got to know my community so well, and I got to really know who are the change makers in my community and are willing to sacrifice time and energy and sleep and everything for la causa. So what do? We have to channel that into something else. It's not enough for me to just be told, just fall in line and vote once in general election and we'll take it from here. No. These are people who are like, I want to put my body on the line. Tell me where I'm supposed to stand and do a sit-in for the cause. Tell me where I'm supposed to organize. Tell me where I'm supposed, this is what is happening right now. And people who are pushing back so strongly, and it's magnificent, going, brand new Congress. We're going to take over. Brand new, it's really a powerful moment. And that's where we're going. That's where we're moving forward with it. And regardless, literally, if Bernie was our president right now, we'd still have to do that. So it's not even like we're doing it like, I guess this is the other thing we have to do since we can't. No, this was what we were always going to be doing next. Always.
And Naomi, I wanted to ask you, because the international aspect of this, we are not in isolation, what is going on here, whether it's Syriza or Podemos or across the world, there is a people's fight back going on, and this is only a reflection of that. I'm wondering your sense of that from your travels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there has been this migration from the streets to forming political parties, and it's complicated, right? Because I completely agree that all of this work on the electoral front and the diversifying and that on every level and brand new Congress, it's really, really important. But we also have to remember that movements produce this moment, right? So I think that we have to do something really complicated where we have to build out all of these electoral possibilities while understanding that these politicians will be nothing unless they are backed by social movements and accountable to those social movements, right?
Yep.
I mean, there would be no Bernie moment without the Fight for 15, Keystone XL, the movement against fracking, Black Lives Matter, the immigrant rights movement, all of it, right? It's not an either or, and I think that that's what's really beautiful about the way we're moving forward is understanding how do we complement each other? How do we make sure that we don't, because I think with some of these movements, right, they went too far in, right? I mean, speaking to some friends in Spain who went from the squares to Podemos, realizing that they lost that street power. Syriza as well, right? And so, everybody is in this process of learning. We're all, we're all in communication with each other. I mean, I remember being in Zuccotti Square and having people from Spain and Egypt there, and that cross-pollination that fed the movements at the grassroots level and are now giving each other ideas at the political level. And by the way, the Podemos leadership will be the first to tell you that they learned from left-wing movements in Latin America. They went to Ecuador, they went to Bolivia,
So we are in conversation, and I'll tell you a funny story. And you know, I have dual citizenship. I'm Canadian. I only tell this among friends that I'm a child of draft dodgers. We came during the Vietnam War. And but my father works in healthcare, so we left the U.S. because of the war, but we stayed for the healthcare, for the universal single payer healthcare. It works, by the way. Anyway, so we found ourselves in a. I want to back up a little bit too around. I just want to insert one point, and I feel my friend Bill McKibben on stage with me now, who's fighting in a sweaty Phoenix hotel room, trying to get the best language in the Democratic Party platform possible, trying to make sure it has strong anti-fracking language and strong language saying we can't be handing out any new fossil fuel leases on federal lands. He's in there. And if Bill were here and he wishes he was here, you know what he would say? We got a deadline, folks. Yes, we're winning, but we don't have all the time in the world. And this is the thing about climate change is we whoever the next president is, they come to power with their backs up against the wall when it comes to climate change, which means there's no honeymoon, baby. There's no give her a chance, we have to be in there demanding no new fossil fuel infrastructure. We need to build the infrastructure of the future. No fossil fuel money. We're going to shame them for every dollar they take from an oil and gas company, from a coal company, every meeting they take. Yeah. We're going to make it toxic, right? I'm a writer, as I mentioned, and I think deadlines help. This is the thing about climate change is it says we have to turn this around by the end of this decade. No joke. Our emissions have to be pointing in a different direction. The challenge we face is how do we transform our energy system, recognizing that we live at a time of multiple overlapping crises, that yes, climate change is an urgent crisis banging down our doors, but so is racial injustice, so is economic inequality, so are all of these other crises we face. So we're not going to play my crisis is bigger than your crisis, first we'll save the planet, then we're worrying about jobs. No, we are going to figure out ways to lower emissions while healing the wounds that date back to the founding of our countries, and it is possible to do. In Canada, we found ourselves in a situation not dissimilar to the one that you are finding yourselves in, where we had an election a year ago, and mostly the energy of that election on the progressive side was the energy of no. This is before everybody got really excited about our hot new prime minister. It was just about getting rid of our right-wing government. And so it was very much a no vote. It was very much a strategic vote. And none of the major progressive, so-called progressive or liberal alternatives were taking climate change seriously, were connecting economic injustice, racial injustice, injustice towards Indigenous people, and the need to act swiftly and with boldness in the face of the climate crisis. And so a group of us got together, 60 movement organizers and leaders, and we wrote our own people's platform called the LEAP Manifesto. And and we launched it right in the middle of the election platform. This was our attempt to say our dreams don't fit on your ballot. We are going to vote out the worst guy, but that does not represent the world we want. And we created space to dream. And what was interesting, just it was that platform, the LEAP Manifesto, was just sort of endorsed by one of our major political parties, the New Democratic Party, and it was the young people. They endorsed it in spirit and resolved to debate it at the riding level across the country. And it was the young people in the party that drove it. And I was watching this play out. I wasn't at the convention, but the young people, several of them were wearing Bernie t-shirts. As they were making their impassioned pleas, that now is the time for boldness, that we can, that small steps are not enough. So we are all feeding each other's movements, and we're all drawing strength from each other.
I wanted to ask John, what's happening to what the future is for labor, not just organized labor, but the actual world of work. You've been doing a lot of work on that recently and the impact of technology on it. Obviously, the organized labor movement dodged a bullet recently when with the death of Scalia, because the Supreme Court could not eliminate dues checkoff. But that's only a temporary issue. But yet the fight for 15 has really created a whole resurgence of the labor movement in large degree. But there's still this issue of what will work look like in the United States and the advanced capitalist countries in years to come.
Some in the audience may think that that is not a question about the 2016 race. In fact, that is the essential question of the 2016 race. Because the fact of the matter is, if we had a media in this country that covered politics, we'd know a lot more about what was going on. If we had a media in this country that covered working life and the condition of workers, things would be very, very different. We don't have that. But this is the essential thing. When you gather with the elites, now I've noticed up here we have just regular water. If this was sparkling water, if we were sitting someplace a little higher up in a building in a very nice elite gathering, only a few of us, you folks, wouldn't be here. What we would be talking about is the future of work. And what we would be saying is there are going to be a lot less jobs because we're going to automate our workplaces. We're going to use the digital revolution and the robot revolution to remake work. I know this is gonna sound crazy, you won't imagine this. We're gonna talk people who are out of work into taking their personal car and driving around looking for somebody who called them on an app, and we're gonna call that work. We're gonna say, oh, well, that's your new job. Right. We're gonna take people who are out of work and we're gonna say, hey, you've got a spare room, why don't you go on some app and rent out your spare room? I know that sounds unimaginable, but the fact of the matter is we are already deep into a digital and automation revolution that is transforming every one of our workplaces, and the wealthiest and most powerful people in the world say that half the jobs that we have today, we won't have in 20 years. Every industry will be transformed. There is one union that I have worked with and dealt with in the United States that is ahead of the curve on this issue and that has actually made the human impact of these changes an issue, and that has said that if we're going to all this automation, if we're going to all this robotification, maybe we ought to worry about the patients in hospitals so that we don't just have robots, but we have human nurses taking care of them. And that is in our book where we write about National Nurses United. And it is the job of panelists here to find ways to say nice things about Roseanne on a regular basis.
I appreciate it.
She did not ask for this, but here's the core thing. If you know what the elites talk about, and if you know the changes that are taking place, and you step back and look at the reality of our moment right now, if you realize we are already deep into this, we're not starting, there are robots in hospitals. There are people driving off apps. There are people renting out their room. And there are people who are struggling to figure out how to cobble together an existence in a rapidly deindustrializing, globalizing, automating society where the wealth goes up, not to the great mass of us. The great movement of the 21st century is going to be to democratize the digital revolution, democratize automation, and say if there's going to be less work, that's great. Let's redistribute the profits so that all of us can work less. And maybe we won't have to pollute as much. And you know who understands that? Because they grew up marinated in this digital culture. Young people. Right. Everybody was always going, how come all these young people are going to the Bernie Sanders rallies? He's old. He's a democratic socialist. He's from Vermont. Where's that? Everybody's like, well, I don't see why this thing is working. Well, the fact of the matter is, young people know the future that is coming toward them. Older people need to figure out that the only way we make that future function is if we have a social welfare state that provides an underpinning for people who are pushed into a gig economy. We need single-payer Medicare for all health care, not because it's a nice thing, but because it's the necessary underpinning of the next economy. We need a financial transactions tax because the billionaires, when they're moving their money around, should give us a little bit of the money that they move around. We need to invest in housing. We need to invest in infrastructure. We need to invest in education. And the fact of the matter is, if we tell people that their future is less and less jobs, less and less opportunity, but we as the left do not provide them with an alternative, with a vision for the 21st century that combines a fight against climate change that wins, and that combines a fight against economic inequality that wins, and a fight against racial injustice that wins, if we don't give them a vision that puts this all together, then they will be pulled to the right, to the extremes, to places that don't work. Our job is to look ahead to a somewhat frightening, sometimes scary future, and to say the only thing that will make it work for all of us is if it works for all of us.
Rosario, getting the message out in a way that masses of people can understand it, grasp it, and move on it. We love to hate the media, and especially I think those few of us who still watch television from time to time or go to the movies, we are continually frustrated by the inability of television and the movies to present any kind of the real life stories of Americans. I'm wondering what kind of battles you've had in terms of getting out a different kind of message in Hollywood among the directors and the producers and the actors that you work with on a regular basis.
Well, we have Josh Fox's film tonight that's immediately after the screening, How to Let Go of the World. How to Let Go of the World. And Love the Things That Climate Can't Change, which is going to be immediately after this panel. We have Michael Moore's film, I think, is going to be playing at midnight, talking about where to invade next. We have the reality and the history behind films like Sicko and seeing how there was a constructed effort to take down that film so as to prevent us from having a consciousness around having universal health care and how well that strategy actually worked. I don't think there's necessarily, yes, in the big tentpole films and the massive amounts of money, it can be quite difficult to get progressive information in them. But even Mark Forster put into a Bond movie the issue of the privatization of water. And you're like, this is a Bond movie, and actually privatizing water isn't illegal, and Bond is going after the bad guys who are trying to privatize water. That is amazing. Thank you, Mark Forster, for somehow injecting that conversation into this big, huge film that a lot of people walking into didn't expect to get that kind of information. And maybe when they're reading about that ongoing struggle across the planet, and when people are talking about fracking and when they're talking about these different issues that are compromising our water, maybe they'll listen that much more because they decided to go en masse on a weekend to go see the new Bond film. So yeah, those are great opportunities. There was a time where you watched a film or a news item on the killing of the whales and people hit the streets. Now you can watch a film that talks about the liabilities of Pat Robertson's work, charity work in Africa, and we can talk about exposing the dangers of fracking and exposing the dangers of our media and the complicity of the media and covering voter suppression and election fraud. You can watch about the private industrial prison complex that feeds into the detention centers and deportation centers, which is now being translated into private treatment centers as people are still making money off of people's misery. And then you watch a commercial that comes on right afterwards. You watch now at the Oscars where people will go and use it as a soapbox moment and talk about all the issues that they care about, and films that are exposing crimes against humanity across the planet, and people clap about it, and then the next thing comes up. Where is the irate, immediate, urgent reaction to that news and the way that we had it before? Because before it was so, it came out in these small little leaks that it was a revelation. Now we are in a point where we are drowning in information when we used to be starved of it. And because we have so much, it's hard to figure out where to move, because you're like, what? What is this news that I didn't know that happened. That's terrible. Oh, wait. Oh, I love this commercial. You know, it's this huge mobilization of people and this recognition of the movement of movements and this clarity behind it and these networking and everything that happens. And then you're told, election's over. She already won. It's all over. This is how it goes. And people go, oh, wait, what? And they're confused. And that is what is happening. It's not that the information isn't there. It's not that Hollywood isn't making those movies or there's not access point. Is it difficult? Can we get into all of that? Of course, yes. But there's a slew of movies right now that you could watch that would blow your mind. They're just sitting on a shelf somewhere. Or you're not being recommended to watch it on your next Netflix run. You know, unless you watch a lot of documentaries. It's just not, the fervor behind it isn't there anymore because they've demystified that information in a way. Now it's okay for you to know that because they don't expect you to do anything about it. And that's really interesting to me. And when I look in the history of propaganda and how Americans, for some reason, because we are taught what propaganda is and how to spell it and its definition, that somehow we don't think we're subject to it, when we very much are. And how that was used for so many years, and looking into Freud and all of these different things that allowed us to kind of get into our psyche and go, oh, so people aren't moved by fact and reason, they're moved by emotion. Great, we can make cartoons about war then and all of us go. And that's exactly what they did and have been doing for years. And you can have this cartoon of entertainment that we see most of the time in our corporate media, and people fall for it because they think that that's what the news is supposed to be. They're talking to us every single day, right? I always say there's an interesting thing as an actor, and people kind of go after me like, oh, your opinion, da, 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 you're just selling something. I'm like, no, see, but there's a difference. You know, when I go out there, I recognize how busy you are, and I'm going, I know, you know, you just got a pink slip, and your husband's ill, and your daughter just broke her leg, and all of these different things. But I have a movie that's coming out this week, and I really hope that you'll check it out. So maybe I'll do a really flashy poster, a really awesome trailer, or spin a phrase, and hope to kind of get through to you in your busyness. They're taking advantage of you in a different way. They know you're so busy, and they're going, you didn't watch the debate. You didn't read all those articles. You don't really know what's going on. Let me tell you what was the most salient points. Let me tell you what the thing is to get upset about, and ignore all, don't even pay attention to any of this other information, because they don't want us connecting with each other and talking to each other. We're in a really remarkable moment where we've gone from being around the circle where everyone had a space to then it being this pyramid of the elites, as you say, on the top, and everyone shouldering more weight than they should be on the bottom. But now we've got this portal that we open up every day. We're back around the fire again, and we connect with each other through Twitter, through Facebook, through just emailing, talking to each other directly, and that's how we're organizing. That's why it's so important when we say that huge list of emails that we've got. That's power. See, in 2008, when Obama spent a bunch of money, billion, and paid organizing to get the presidency, which was still really difficult, the Koch brothers took a feather out of that hat and said, oh, okay, I get it. You need a lot of people, you need a lot of money. Cool, Tea Party. And they've done so much taking that feather out of that hat of how big that could be. Money and people makes a lot, is a great combination. Now we've seen that in a whole other way, because we had someone who said, based on my rhetoric and my record alone, I'm going to go out there, and if the people want me, they'll pay for it. and they, he did something against the system. Understanding, yes, it does take people, and it does take a lot of money, but why does it always have to be that small group of people up here who have a lot of money up there? Why can't it, why can't we democratize it and put it out to all of us and see who they choose? And that power, as I'm already seeing people going, how can we channel that again? How can we funnel that again? We know something, and once you know something, you can't unknow it. And we know how powerful we are. And now we're taking that feather out of the Koch brothers' hat of just going, okay, people and money. We got that. Because there's a lot of us. And if we only even just gave $3 each, there's 180 million people with $3 each. That's a lot of money. That's game-changing. And it's continuing to own our narrative in order to continue propelling us forward. That's the key thing, is just making sure that we are on that same page and talking to each other and not believing this idea that it's over, that this mirrors something in the past. Because when you're talking about virtual reality and people being having this opportunity in this moment to go, I want to be able to be on a refugee site or on a reservation and have it for myself to know what this is. I want to make up my own opinion about this. The self-education that's happening, people who are going, no, I actually am moved by reason and fact, and that's how I'm going to mobilize. That's a huge moment in our history. It might not have seemed to make a big difference, the Occupy movement, right? Because it came and it went. Millions of people marched to prevent a war in Iraq before it happened. It came and it went. But we saw each other. And we keep, as you keep saying, building on that. And now we're at a crescendo, and that's not going away. We are going to continue rising because we're able to talk to each other and keep each other going. That's how it started, and that's how it's going to keep making the impact that it is. 1.3 million people went to go see Bernie Sanders speak in person. They didn't just look up videos. They didn't go, I already registered, and then I'm going to go vote later. I phone banked, I canvassed. I don't have to go and go a couple miles to go and stand there for hours in the sun or the cold for you. But they did that as well. And that is really important thing to pay attention to. I've talked to so many activism people, like, oh, I've been waiting for this generation. I can say the same thing because I'm not a millennial. I'm 37. I missed that boat. That's cool. I'm slow on the Snapchat game, but that's fine. Because I've been waiting for this moment too. God, I'm so glad to finally stop being asked why I have so many causes that I care about. Can't you just pick one? No, because there's an intersectionality. All of them work or don't work with each other. That's why I'm not modeled. And when I talk to these young people, they're like, yeah, I'm totally down with that. I'm here for your cause, and I want you to like mine. When you come to my event, if you come to yours, I'll promote yours, you help my... Like, there's this intersectionality that is happening, and there's an understanding and ability to juggle those many different issues at once when they've been told so often to just pick one. They're like, no. And neither do I like this idea of just picking between two people for president. I want more choices, and I'm capable of deliberating through those choices. Don't make that choice for me. That's the moment that we're in, a major pushback. So the question was, is it reform? Is it transform? It's definite change. I'm definitely more for reform than conform, for damn sure.
I wonder, we're almost out of time, but I couldn't pass up this chance. I wanted to tell you a quick story. We're talking about the young people. I have a 16, well, she's just about to turn 17-year-old daughter, and who, in her high school in Harlem, all these Black and Latino kids, they were all Bernie supporters. And she'd come, you know, she'd talk to me, Dad, so what's the latest? What's going on between Bernie and Hillary? At one point, she says to me, you know, everybody in my school is for Bernie. I said, you all for a 74-year-old guy? How are you getting your information? Oh, and she would run down. And she said, you know, Dad, if they would lower the voting age to 16, Bernie would win. I said, yeah, but Gabriella, I'm not sure that I support lowering the voting age to 16. Anyway, but I wanted to ask Roseanne last question that I asked you this morning when you were on Democracy Now! About the DNC's not wanting you on the platform committee because they didn't want a labor representative, a union representative on the platform committee. Can you
Can you talk about that? Because getting your head around that, that the Democratic Party doesn't want a labor representative on its platform committee, is astounding.
Well, I think they don't want this labor representative. And you know what, Juan? They're right, because I just had to go on to testify. The Sanders campaign asked me to come on to the committee today via Skype right before here and testify, and it was extremely contentious because even the progressive there were trying to, they were trying to box, I finally just confronted them. They were trying to box me to say that the ACA is essentially good enough and that people, we really can't get to single payer. And this was partially the issue. The other issue is my extreme contempt for how the DNC has moved to the right. And they're, yeah, and they're in the pocket. No. Ultimately, what I could see in the interaction, I finally just called them on it. And I said, look, this is, can we just call this for what it is? You want me to say that the Democrats fought hard enough for single payer and that the ACA was good enough. And I said, well, I work with the nurses, and I can tell you that every life matters. If you can't fight for, if you can't get out there and fight for the patients, if you every single, when you make a compromise in healthcare, you're basically issuing a death sentence because you're saying that the lives don't matter. And what I said, and even Representative Barbara Lee, they used Barbara to try to chill me out, I think, which was sad, kind of. But that, you know, they were making this kind of urgent plea to me that they worked as hard as they could, and the ACA, it was very interesting to see the power that this movement brought. That's how I felt, by the way, when I was talking to the DNC today. I could feel your power. Trust me on that. Because they were on the defensive. I thought, oh, I'm just one person, there's a whole bunch of them.
Yep.
And I'm one person, but I'm not one person. Because I'm speaking with our collective voice from this movement.
Absolutely.
And I would never agree. And so, you know, even Barbara Lee said, but this is as far as we could get. And I said, what you should have learned from the Sanders campaign is you don't cut these deals in Washington, D.C. 58% of the people in this country support a single-payer system. Go out there in the field and find them and bring them into Congress and tell Congress that we want single-payer.
With that rousing cheer, I think we're going to end the conversation because I was told to be sure to wrap it up by 9 p.m. I do want to add that there are going to be several films starting, I think, at 9:30, and Michael's going to come up to explain where they're going to be. Fix It with filmmaker Richard Master. How to Love What Climate Can't Change with filmmaker Josh Fox, and they're all here. And one film that I'm particularly fond of, which Harvest of Empire, which deals with the whole immigration battle in the country, and more importantly, the sources and the reasons for the mass migrations, which is based on my book on the history of Latinos, and that'll be showing as well. So I want you all, though, to give a rousing hand for our four panelists, Roseanne DeMauro, John Nichols, Naomi Klein, and Rosario Dawson.
And Juan Gonzalez. Juan Gonzalez.
Juan Gonzalez.
And have a great rest of the conference.